that is me. Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you in the driver's seat, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks on the other side of the glass, engineering and producing the show. Tom, say it ain't so. I saw you were preparing the forecast for your news updates. Did I see a 110 degree high sneaking in the 5 day?
That's what they're saying, whoever they are.
Well, we know this story. We've got to get through some hot weather to get to really crank up the monsoon.
Well, as long as it doesn't get up around 115, I've got my fingers crossed.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, take 110 any day over 115. It's the Buckmaster Show Thursday. It's the 26th. Day of June 2025. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. It's all part of the Bustos Media growing presence here in Tucson. Our studios are in central Tucson. We have five radio stations under one roof. This one's 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice for trusted live local news and talk. We're 14 and a half years into our radio program and 37 and a half years now in radio and television just in this particular market. Have our worldwide live listening of our program at buckmastershow.com, which is also the place for all of our podcasts. And the complete archive is there available for you when we do our telephone interviews at 790-2040. Our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Once a month, we like to check in with our contributor on public health, and he knows a lot about public health. It's Will Humble, the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will's been in the business a long time. Four decades in the public health field. In that period and on his resume, 2 decades at the Arizona Department of Health Services, where he served in various roles, including the agency director from 2009 to 2015. He joins us now on the live line. Will, how are you?
Hey, good, Bill. How you been?
I've been doing really well. We're hoping to get some rain here, other than a little brief shower the other day during the program. We have, of course, had no rain, virtually no rain, and Phoenix is as dry as a bone as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah, except like 3 weeks ago, there was a weird, like I got a half an inch about 3 weeks ago.
What?
Remember that? Didn't you get it in Tucson?
That's right.
Yeah, remember that?
Don't forget
about that, Bill.
Yeah, I forgot about it. The Buckmaster Bungalow on June 1st had a half an inch. I completely forgot about that, Will.
And I'm still proudly running my swamp coolers.
Yeah.
My goal is 4th of July.
You are now one of probably, I don't know, here in Tucson, maybe 10%. People that still run the swamps, and you swear by it, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I cut your utility bill by 2/3.
Uh-huh.
Plus, I like the humidity, and I can fix it myself. I don't have to call anybody.
There you go.
It's old, you know, it's simple technology.
Well, speaking of fixing it, boy, the legislature, the lawmakers cannot seem to get this thing together, and I remember some of those days where they have shut the clock off on June 30th, and they were basically saying that we're going to get this done early in the morning of July 1st. Of course, Arizona operates on a fiscal year, and it's interesting. There has never been a state shutdown in Arizona history. That, I don't know, that could happen this time. What do you think?
I don't think it's going to happen. But
okay.
We have had, back when I was on my old job running the state health department, I think twice or maybe three times, we had federal government shutdowns. And about 2/3 of the money that goes to at least the agency I was running comes from the feds. We effectively had a shutdown because if your people are on federal money, even though they're state employees, we had to send them home. So it's quasi happened before. I think I mean, the House of Representatives, the state house, is having a temper tantrum this week. They'll get over it.
Yeah.
I think by tomorrow is my guess.
Yeah, well, we'll find out what happens. We'll have an update with the assistant minority leader. I checked in with Nancy Gutierrez this morning, and if at all possible, she's going to be joining us on our Friday focus interview tomorrow. But when you look at this spending program, I know you've got a pet peeve on one of the items. I believe it's called House Bill 2704.
Yeah, that's my... Yeah, I did a blog post about, there's a lot of good stuff in the Senate negotiated budget, but I wanted to throw in one that just irks me a bit. It's not exactly public health related, but it is sort of. It's, the owners of Mr. Kendrick, the owner of the Arizona Diamondbacks, he believes that facility up here needs a whole bunch of improvements. And, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, they were able to set up a entertainment district so that they could get some resources to fix the stadium up. But that would have required a surcharge on people that attend the games. And so they can still do that, but he doesn't want to put a surcharge on ticket prices, basically a user fee for people, people that go to the games ought to, in my view, be the ones that pay to improve whatever needs to be done to the stadium. He doesn't like that idea. So they went to the state legislature to try to get state revenue to pay for that stadium upgrade. And in effect, what ends up happening is that over the next 20 years, the team, well, the stadium will have about a $1.2 billion to make changes to that stadium. $1.2 billion. That's more than the value of the team.
Yeah, it
by
is.
By the way,
it is.
The team's worth about $1.3 billion. So it's about the same value as the team. So they're going to get that by taking away the sales tax and the income tax for all the players and staff for that team. And so instead of that going to the state general fund, it's going to go to the stadium. I mean, you probably have some listeners who think this is a good idea. I don't.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to do anything, make the owner pay for the upgrades. He has a sweet lease to begin with. They don't pay much in rent at the place anyway. Or have fans. You're buying a $15 beer, put an extra surcharge on it.
Yeah.
Or lower the price of your beers, by the way.
How about this? Why doesn't the billionaire that owns the Diamondbacks take care of these improvements himself? He probably wouldn't even feel that on his bottom line, but,
No, but because, and here's what they did, is they go to the legislature and then they go to the I don't know if it was in the Star and stuff, but up here in the Republic, they're quoted, well, we just have to move, so they threatened like moving to Las Vegas or Salt Lake City or something. And that's what all these billionaire owners do. They threaten to move until they get a sweet enough deal. And so we don't want to spend the whole show on this.
No, there's some breaking health news, and several listeners have just pointed out they want your take on it. They heard at the during the CBS top of the hour news that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Is not recommending the flu shot. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I hadn't heard that yet because I was driving over to where I'm doing this show. So I'd have to check into it, but I can't really opine on it. Because I don't know what he actually said or what his CDC director has said, and or for which populations he's talking about. I'm not surprised because he's got a 20-year track record of just being anti-vaccine. And now he has the power of the state that he can, move that opinion into public policy because that HHS secretary job has a lot of authority. And 35% of the federal budget, by the way. So he has a lot that he can do. So I haven't read the details of it, so I can't really opine about that yet, Bill.
What he has changed the staff quite a bit, hasn't he? The group that oversees kind of approving these vaccines.
So he didn't change the approval people that much. He changed the recommendation people. So here's the way vaccines work in the U.S. So a vaccine manufacturer, they'll come up with the idea. They do the clinical trials for a new vaccine. Let's just imagine it's a new pneumonia vaccine, for example, let's say. They do the clinical trials, phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials. And then when they're ready to license the vaccine, they say, okay, we're ready to get a license. They go to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to get that license. And that's a prescribed process. And then, you know, if they did all their work right, if the clinical trials were right, if the benefits, if it was both safe and effective, the FDA will then license or approve that. That doesn't make it so that people are able to get the vaccine yet. That's just a license. What really matters is what the CDC does afterwards. And that is they make the recommendations about what vaccines people should get. And why that's important is because the health plans, Medicare, Medicaid, the private health insurance plans, the VA, the Vaccines for Children program, all of them use the recommendations that CDC comes out with to decide what they're going to pay for.
Mm.
Well, and so what Kennedy has done is not strip the licenses of these vaccines, because if he did that, he'd get sued and he'd lose. Rather, what he's doing is removing recommendations for vaccines, which means that when you go to the doctor's office, there'll be a license. Let's say you need the pneumonia shot, just as an example. You might go to the doctor's office and they'd say, well, we have the vaccine in the fridge, but your health plan doesn't pay for it because it's not recommended by the CDC anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want it, you can have it, but it's going to cost you $230.
Yeah.
I mean, so then people say no. So you lower vaccination rates, but without pulling the licenses for these vaccines. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what his MO has been and continues to be, given what you just said about the influenza vaccine.
Yeah, and I have some more on that before we take the break. Here's the latest on that, and this news is really, really breaking within the last hour that Kennedy, his vaccine advisors voted today to no longer recommend that Americans get flu shots containing a preservative that anti-vaccine activists have suggested is linked to autism.
Okay. So, all right, then that's not as bad as what it sounded at first.
Okay.
Okay, what they're talking about there is, so most of the vaccines that you get, your influenza vaccine, for example, you go to the pharmacy, your doctor's office, it'll be in a pre-filled syringe, a one-dose pre-filled syringe.
Okay.
Okay. That does not have thimerosal as a preservative in it. And so the vast majority of the vaccines they're talking about are not affected because they don't have the preservative. The multi-dose vials, which contain 10 doses that you have to draw down your syringe, those are mostly used in rural health clinics. Those do have that preservative. So what Kennedy's group is saying is we don't think that those multi-dose vials should have the preservative in it, which just means that the manufacturers are going to just have to shift and not make the multi-dose vials anymore and just do pre-filled syringes. So I don't think that'll have a huge negative impact.
Okay. So
they can take care of that.
I can still get a flu shot then probably this.
You will still be able to. Now,
this fall.
If you lived in Douglas, it might be harder.
Yeah. All right. Rural health is a huge and continuing to be a huge problem in this state and this country. All right, Will Humble, stick around. Segment two is coming up after we take our first break on the Buckmaster Show Thursday edition. We will be right back.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
Vero Amore, where every certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore is located in the lovely Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell. Also, check out the full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamorepizza.com. The Regional Transportation Authority invests over $100 million annually in transportation improvements in the greater Tucson region based on public input. The RTA and its regional partners deliver roadway, transit, safety, pedestrian, bicycle, environmental, and other needed improvements to meet the demands of transportation network users over a 20-year period. Learn more about the economic and quality of life benefits of the RTA's 2006 voter-approved plan and flexible funding at rtamobility.com.
Travel is in my DNA. When I'm ready to start another adventure, my trip begins and ends at our local airport, Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. TUS, where it's made easy to fly. Start planning now for your next air adventure by visiting flytucson.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios where we do our telephone interviews, which we're doing currently. Our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. The former director of the Arizona State Health Department is with us on the live line. He's Will Humble, and he's also our contributor, one of two dozen regular contributors to our program. Will's specialty is public health. And when we see these increases, Arizona Public Service, TEP, asking the ratepayers to take care of another, I don't know, the percentage varies, I don't know, 5, 10%. It does have a public health impact, doesn't it, Will Humble?
Yeah, I wrote a blog about that this week because, you know, I wanted people to understand that there's a link between these monopoly utilities and the way the Corporation Commission just basically rubber stamps these rate increases that they're asking for, that their shareholders really benefit from. And that's who benefits from these rate increases, are the people who have the stock in those electric companies. That when rates keep going up, and you know, there's been two back-to-back 8% rate increases for APS, not similar with Tucson Power, not just exactly the percentage, then APS, the big statewide utility, asked for another 14% just this week. Increase on top of the 2 8% back-to-backs they just had. I'm told Tucson Power's asking for a similar rate increase, 14%. These are rate increases way above inflation.
Yeah.
And another thing that irritated me about this rate increase request by APS is that they also asking the commission, the Corporation Commission, to give them another increase in what's called their allowed return on equity. So that what that means is that they can, at least right now, the utilities are limited to a rate, no matter what they're, you know, they're collecting in electrical bills, that, you know, they can earn a 9.7% return on their equity, and they want that boosted up way above even 10%. So what that means is they're not just raising rates, you know, to cover their expenses. They're raising rates because they want to increase their balance sheet. And in order to do that, they even need an increase in their return on equity. And what's so frustrating is that voters keep putting people in the Arizona Corporation Commission who just rubber stamp these rate increases. And I'll get to the health part in a second. I mean, it has a real life health impact, especially with low income people and people on fixed incomes, where, you know, utility bills, electrical bills just keep going up and up and up. And, you know, their Social Security check doesn't keep going up and up and up. It only goes up like 3% a year or something. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go up 10% a year. And so it gets harder and harder for people to make ends meet, and they end up making choices like, you know, I have to buy unhealthy food, or I'm going to skip food, or I'm not going to pay for my medications, or, you know, they end up having to make choices. Or, by the way, they turn our thermostat up to where it's not healthy.
Yes.
And especially for seniors.
Yes.
You know, you put your house above 80, you're putting your life at risk.
You really are. That is such a good point. And by the way, it is a 14% increase, folks, here in southern Arizona. This has been widely reported that TEP wants that kind of an increase. They will prevent, I understand they cannot turn the power off during the summer season. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that about 3 or 4 years ago, that and we had a bunch of deaths up here in the Phoenix area. I don't know about Tucson. And it became pretty high profile. And so finally the Corporation Commission put a moratorium. Utilities voluntarily did it before it was a mandate. Doesn't mean your bill goes away. You know, they're still coming out for your collections, but they can't turn you off until October 15th. But that's beside the point of my, you know, my attitude is, look, you know, you're a monopoly. You should be regulated in a way where it is in the public's interest, you know, not the shareholders of your Pinnacle West Corporation's interest. It needs to be in the interest of the public. But sadly, the folks on the Corporation Commission these days don't appear to see it that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it's a word called regulatory capture. It means that the people who make the decisions on the behalf of the people are more beholden to the industry than they are to actual voters. And until people start realizing that and vote for people for the Corporation Commission who have their interest rather than the interest of the shareholders of the corporation, it's going to keep staying like this, I think.
Yeah, I think you've made some very valid points, Will Humble. Are we getting any more scrutiny, shedding any more light on an industry that needs to have light shed on it? And that's the assisted care living industry.
Yeah, so that's the good news of today's segment. up here in the Arizona Republic ran a series of stories the last couple of years about the substandard care that has been provided in assisted living and skilled nursing facilities in Arizona. Part of what they discovered in that series, which was really widely read up here, at least in the Valley, and your subscribers down in Tucson will have read this series too, you know, it demonstrated I lost my train of thought here.
Mm-hmm. It demonstrated that this industry needs some help, right?
Yeah. Demonstrated that the particular area where the worst care was being provided was among people with dementia that lived in those facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a big outcry among a lot of families after that article came out, and because of the article, honestly, urging the legislature and the state health department to update their standards for dementia care in senior living facilities. And the state health department just recently finished that rulemaking. And so those new regulations are now in place. They still need to be enforced, but at least for people with dementia living in care facilities, there will be moving forward some better standards. Now, that still means that you have to enforce those standards, but it doesn't mean there'll be immediate improvements. But my fingers are crossed that things will start to get better.
That's an industry that just really suffers from a work shortage. They just they can't find enough people to work in these facilities, and then the people they do sometimes can be questionable.
Right. And another thing that happens is that for people that are wealthier, that have, you know, saved a lot of money over the years, they buy into some of the more high-end types of facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And those facilities end up paying a lot more for the caregivers. And so they're poaching when there's talented staff in the air, you know, in some of the care homes that are more affordable. They poach a lot of the good staff, And so that leaves a bigger challenge. So there's also an income component of that.
Well, before we wrap it up, I know Phoenix has really gone all in on cooling centers. Tucson has followed the lead. Do you think that effort's going to save lives this summer?
Yeah, I do think that it will save lives compared to what would have been had they not done it. You see what I'm saying? Like heat deaths are now I think 12th leading cause of death, right, with pneumonia and influenza in Arizona. It didn't used to be that way. Mm-hmm. In large part, people blame climate change and the urban heat islands for it, and that's a portion of it. But a much bigger part of it is that Arizona just simply does not have the kind of supported housing that's needed for people with a serious mental illness. So let's dive into that for just a second if we have time. There are about 70,000 people with a serious mental illness in Arizona. That's things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, the severe, that kind of thing. Folks like that need to have secure, stable housing in order for them to recover and to be able to live, just live, basically.
Real quickly, Will.
Arizona doesn't have enough places for them to live. And so basically, Bill, 50% of the people that you see that are homeless in our communities are people with a serious mental illness that should be getting supported housing. So this isn't just about water stations.
All right.
We should be getting better housing.
Thank you, Will. Have a great day.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the cool thank goodness for air conditioning, right? I remember those signs growing up in Chicagoland, it's cool inside. And that usually was at a local theater. Greg McNamee is with us and Bruce Dingus. Do you guys remember those signs?
Oh,
it's cool inside.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go to the theater and then we'd head to the Dairy Queen.
Well, I lived on a farm, so we just took off our clothes later on the linoleum in the circular fan.
There you go.
And I grew up in the South where you have to wear a parka in the summertime. If you go indoors, they keep it so cold.
The swan. It was interesting. Will Humble, our monthly guest on public health, says he is one of the few people left in Arizona with a swamp cooler because he says he can fix it himself.
But that reminds me, do you remember the phone number of Bouchelle Rug Cleaners? Hudson 32700?
I do remember that, yeah.
Everybody from
Let's
Chicago.
Start talking about Chicagoland advertising like the Ham's Beer, the land of sky blue waters. Anyway, we're in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. When we do our telephone interviews, it's Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Check out Green Things, greenthingsaz.com, and their sister business, zocalovillage.com. Time for our quarterly segment. What are you reading these days with Bruce and Greg, writer, journalist, editor, photographer, and publisher? Greg McNamee has written or is the title page editor of 45 books. Has it gone up since? Are you at 46 yet or no?
No, I've been slacking off.
Yeah, I thought so. Including Tortillas, This One, and T-Bones, one of his fine titles, a book history of the Southwest, and Gila, The Life and Death of an American River. And, of course, we talk about the Gila National Wilderness every day on the program because that's where Silver City is located, one of our great sponsors. Greg is the operator of Sonora Word Works, an editorial and publishing service, and Bruce Dingus is a retired Arizona Historical Society editor. He edited the Journal of Arizona History. And Greg, we might point out, and I will point out, chairs the selection committee that selects the Southwest Books of the Year for the Pima County Library. I noticed, Greg, that the library has named a new librarian for the system. I believe she comes from Berkeley, perhaps. You guys, Bruce, did
you
hear that?
I've been in Flagstaff. I know nothing right now. So
I think I've got that right. Anyway, Greg also has been a judge in the competition of Southwest Books of the Year for 3 decades. Let's begin with Bruce this quarter, and you're focusing on a book about Mark Twain.
Yeah, Ron Chernow, his new biography of Mark Twain. Ernest Hemingway claimed that all modern American literature comes from one book by Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. There was nothing before. There's been nothing as good since. Mm-hmm. And skeptics will find abundant evidence of supporting Hemingway's claim in this 1,200-page chronicle of the life and artistry of our nation's iconic humorist and writer by the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Grant and Hamilton. Diving deep into the Twain archive, Chernow traces Twain's career from his Missouri boyhood, Rocky Mountain journalist, best-selling author, and iconic humorist, in a world populated with the likes of Ned Buntline, P.T. Barnum, and Buffalo Bill Cody. Twain became a precursor of today's celebrity culture. Along with Charles Dickens, he demolished the stereotype of the brooding, reclusive writer. Although ironically, Twain, beset by business failures and family tragedies, became melancholy and resentful in later life. My favorite story of Twain's is, although he was himself chronically short of cash, worked to guide dying ex-president Grant's memoir to completion and publication. The result, at least in my opinion, is, along with the journals of Lewis and Clark and Twain's own Huckleberry Finn, a classic of 19th century American literature. Chernow has gifted us with a comprehensive, entertaining, and endlessly interesting portrait of an American original.
All right, Mark Twain, the leadoff. Ron Chernow, he's been very prolific, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I mean, he's got at least three biographies before this that I know, and they're all in that 1,000-page range.
Oh, boy, better have... Well, take that one on to the beach with you.
Yeah.
That will take care of your...
use it for summary. Yeah.
And by the way, I did say they have appointed Tess Meyer will be the library director, and Tess comes from Berkeley Public Library System before coming over to Tucson, and she'll start in September, and of course... We will get to know her on the show. Yeah. Greg McNamee, what are you leading with this month?
Well, I'm going to talk about a book that concerns a fellow who I think is a good descendant of Mark Twain, and that is, if you attended the first few editions of the Tucson Festival of Books, you may have had the good fortune to have met or heard Elmore Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
I know you interviewed him.
I did. I spent an hour with him at one of the Tucson Festivals of Books, and it might have been... he passed about 10 years ago. It was shortly before he passed. Mm-hmm. It was maybe a year or two. But anyway, go ahead, Greg.
Well, it's a good thing it was before and not after. It would have been a one-sided conversation.
It would have made some news, wouldn't it?
Well, Elmore Leonard went by the nickname Dutch after a boyhood baseball hero. Hmm. But Dutch Leonard didn't much write about baseball. Instead, he said his real heroes were the, quote, desperados roaming the Midwest and holding up banks when he was a kid during the Depression era, growing up in Detroit. And so it was that Leonard wrote about cowboys and outlaws and shoot 'em ups. And as biographer C.M. Cushions recounts in his book, Cooler Than Cool, turning in stories like 310 to Yuma that would rank at the top of the Western canon. By the mid-1950s, he was writing more novels than stories and trying to kind of make a niche in the comfortable Saturday Evening Post kind of writing. And it didn't work, so he went back to a different kind of genre fiction, turned to crime writing. And he took the point of view of the street-smart hustler often and declared, I'm not all that interested in the way educated people think. Well, after the success of books like Freaky Deaky and Get Shorty, books intensely researched and planned out to the last comma with just those hustlers at heart, Leonard's work's now prized by educated people. And not even as a guilty pleasure. You know, he's enshrined in the Library of America now among the classics of American writing. So though he is associated with genre writing, with Westerns and screenplays and crime, Leonard was turned out to be a fine literary writer and undeniably cool, too.
Very cool, and thus the title, Cooler Than Cool, The Life and Work of Elmore Leonard. Bruce Dingus, what do you have for us next?
Aaron Cohen, I'm thinking of our famous book dealer.
Yeah.
Aaron John Curtis, Old School Indian. This debut novel introduces us to a new voice in Native American fiction. At first glance, the plot is simple. Abe Jacobs, a Miami bookstore clerk with a failing marriage and incurable autoimmune disease, returns for healing to his family roots in the Mohawk Reservation in upstate New York. But once his feet touch familiar earth, the story explodes in wonderful and unexpected directions, many of them uproariously funny, including a nagging inner poetic muse named Dominic Deerwoods, that lay bare the debilitating effects of colonialism while at the same time revealing the complexities at the core of an otherwise simple question, who is an Indian? As Abe reconnects with family and friends and watches his marriage slip through his fingers, we gradually discover along with him the healing properties of culture and tradition. Curtis is a talent to be reckoned with. By pure coincidence, I read this book published just last month, back-to-back with Native Son, Richard White's brilliant and unsettling 1940 novel of black rage and white retribution in the urban Midwest. Add Tommy Orange's There, There, and Wandering Stars, set within Oakland, California's displaced Indian population, and despite their disparities in tune and substance, you have a compelling critique of generational racism's toll on individuals and communities.
Aaron John Curtis, the book Old School Indian. All right, before the break, Greg, give us another one.
Okay, got Sarah Lynn Wynn Williams, excuse me. You probably heard of a little internet company called Facebook. Well, New Zealand diplomat Sarah Wynn Williams talked her way into an ambassadorial job there. in 2011 on the grounds that it was going to become a political giant. She foresaw that, and she also foresaw that governments would want to figure out ways to control the institution, and she meant to keep Facebook independent. She says, information is power. At some point, governments would want to control it. And that's just right, she says, in Careless People, A Cautionary Tale of Power, Greed, and Lost Idealism. Mark Zuckerberg, the co-founder, alleged co-founder, outwardly apolitical, but he also liked hanging out with dictators, like Fidel Castro. Wanted to be seated next to Fidel Castro at a dinner party, for example. And he rejected a West German, or a German rather, enterprise intended to curb hate speech. Well, hate speech is bread and butter for Facebook, as everybody knows who looked at the political rancor that rose up in the last election time and any election time. So the modern extremist world, Wynn Williams writes, was created in some good measure by Facebook, the company she tried to keep independent and tried to keep moderate. Zuckerberg, she says, now crafts enemies lists and sells data to China. And really? It all adds up to what she calls lethal carelessness.
Boy, it's a book I'm sure that Facebook would rather not have.
They tried to sit on it. They tried to put an injunction on its sale, and were rejected by the courts.
Fascinating. So, Careless People, A Cautionary Tale of Power, Greed, and Lost Idealism. Bruce and Greg, stick around. We've got another segment coming up. A couple of more picks for folks with summer reading ideas. Buckmaster on a Thursday. Be right back.
Located in the heart of Arizona wine country, about an hour south of Metro Tucson, Flying Leap Estate Vineyards Winery and Distillery Facilities are one of the most beautiful wine venues in the southwestern United States. Come relax and unwind at our spacious property and learn about Arizona grape viticulture and winemaking from our team of trained sommeliers and discover the intricacies of the art of distillation. Learn more at flyingleapvineyards.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan is funded by a half-cent sales tax through June 2026. The funding has led to a $1.6 billion investment in regional transportation improvements over the past two decades to improve your quality of life. The RTA is working on a final draft of a new regional transportation plan for future voter consideration. The $2.46 billion draft plan includes roadway, transit, safety, bicycle, pedestrian, environmental, and other needed improvements. Learn more at rtanext.com.
This is your captain speaking. Thank you for flying with Tucson International Airport, where you can avoid the hassles, long lines, and the expensive parking of the Phoenix Airport. Skip the traffic, breeze through security, and park with ease, all while supporting your community. Every flight from TUS brings more destinations and better connections right here to Tucson. So next time you're planning a getaway, remember, fly easy, fly local, fly TUS. This is your captain signing off. We're cleared for takeoff.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studio, when we do our telephone interviews, the live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management, Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Wow, it sells itself this time of year because of the elevation. It's going to be at least 10 degrees cooler. They're getting a rain shower right now over in Grant County, New Mexico, where it's a very pleasant 76 degrees. It must be a really nice afternoon over there. You can join the fun. Travel about 3 hours. Hit I-10, take a left at Lordsburg, head up the mountain. Start your planning by visiting southwestnewmexico.org. Greg McNamee knows a little bit about Silver City because he wrote a book, Gila, The Life and Death of an American River. Greg is one of our two, well, call them literary critics of the Buckmaster Show. We like to call it our quarterly segment, What Are You Reading These Days? Bruce and Greg, and you know, I introduced the Greg. Well, the Bruce is Bruce Dingus, who for years was involved as the editor of the Journal of Arizona History and served forever on that Southwest Books of the Year. That makes it sound like you must be like ancient or something, Bruce.
I feel ancient
but
sometimes.
Actually, you and I are from the same class of high school, and we won't mention which class it is. But anyway, so we are contemporaries. Let's talk a little bit about a book called A Passing Wheel. A Passing West.
Essays from the Borderlands. Yeah, in this 2025 Penn Award-winning collection, the author of The Magic of Blood, Woodcuts of Women, and The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuna offers up an homage to his homeland, a place he calls Mexican America, in particular the Hispanic Southwest. In elegantly honed prose that is both colloquially and poetic, he addresses a sweeping range of topics from his working-class upbringing in L.A., his evolution as a writer, and experiences in Spain, Mexico, and Guatemala, to migrant labor, food, customs, culture, and literature. The thread tying it all together is the deep, often unacknowledged legacy of Spain and Mexico in the New World and the steady growth of America's Mexican-American population, projected in the near future as high as one of every two residents in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Florida, and California. Gilb shouts out, "Look at us," and in the process reminds readers of his own, in my opinion, underappreciated literary chops. I was also reminded that one evening when Gilb and Doug Peacock invited me to go out for drinks. I declined, and I'm here to tell. And as a result, I'm still here to tell the tale.
All right, A Passing West. And now let's go over to Greg McNamee, who's going to take us for a quick surf lesson.
Yeah, when I first moved to Tucson half a century ago, I took a weekend trip over to San Diego to surf. I'd surfed all up and down the East Coast.
Oh.
And I thought I was a pretty good surfer. But
they have
the
surfing
Pacific,
on the East Coast?
Okay, yeah, but the Pacific
ahead.
Is a different beast.
Yeah.
It's cold, it's rough, and it chewed me up pretty thoroughly. Taught me a good lesson. Well, David Litt, who was a one-time speechwriter for Barack Obama, discovered just that, and he opens his memoir, It's Only Drowning, with the sensible observation that surfing is for lunatics.
It's only drowning.
Then comes COVID,
yeah,
and isolation, and going crazy with inaction. So a lunatic opportunity to wander into a surf shop with their mask on, buy a wetsuit and head for the water, hanging out with a brother-in-law in Litt's case who disagreed with him on every point of politics, but agreed with him on good water. And he said, "I imagine learning to surf would be a fun but manageable challenge like learning a language," Litt writes. "It was only later that I revised my view. Learning to surf is like learning a language that wants to kill you." And that's just so. And once he's mastered the waves of New Jersey, he's ready to try his luck in California, where he gets chewed up pretty thoroughly. And then, lunally enough, Hawaii's North Shore, which is, you know, that's the graduate school.
It's the gold standard. Yeah. Gold standard, yeah, for surfing up,
well,
on the North Shore
is
of Oahu.
A great, yeah, entertainment, just the thing for a surfer or maybe an armchair surfer in your household.
And I'm the only one in this room who tried to surf on Lake Michigan. It did happen. Oh, yes. All right, Bruce Dingus, what are you going to wrap it up with, your fourth pick?
Brian Burrow, The Gunfighters, How Texas Made the West Wild. In the wake of his bestsellers, The Big Rich and Forget the Alamo, Burrow has become Texas's preeminent mythbuster, and he's at it again. Reviewing the roster of trigger-happy psychopaths who spread mayhem across the West from Reconstruction to the turn of the 20th century, he believes that an unusual number shared a common characteristic. They were Texan. Take away Texas, he argues in a recent Texas Monthly article, and the American gunfighter era shrinks to insignificance. It all began, he tells us, with besieged settlers caught between Comanches and Mexicans and evolved during and after the Civil War into a warped code of honor that justified lynchings and family feuds. From there, it spread with astonishing speed north and west with the cattle drives. Of course, historians have ridden this trail before, and doubters of Texas exceptionalism are certain to raise objections. Nonetheless, Burrow tells a rousing good story and offers plenty of fodder for vigorous, hopefully not deadly, debate.
So the gunslingers predominantly came from Texas.
He makes a good case for it, but I'm a bit suspicious, but it doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the heck out of the book.
All right, closing out our picks from Greg McNamee.
So another book about the ocean, since it's summertime and we think of the ocean when we're not thinking of Silver City. Mm-hmm. At the bottom of the world's oceans and seas, reckons British journalist Sophie Elmhurst, are 3 million broken boats and ships. Some of them thousands of years underwater.
Yeah.
Some of them just yesterday. Yeah. One of those boats was a 30-foot yacht called the Aura Lynn, which went to the Pacific seafloor in 1973 after a collision with a whale.
Wow.
And that incident lies at the heart of Elmhurst's book, A Marriage at Sea, the true story of love, obsession, and shipwreck, which recounts what brought 40-year-old Maurice Bailey and his 32-year-old wife, Marilyn, from their quiet home in northwestern England out onto the water in the middle of the ocean. They'd long nursed the idea of running away from it all, sailing off to New Zealand. Mm. And they made their way across the Atlantic, rounded South America, and then smacked into that whale somewhere near the Galapagos Islands, but not near enough to know where. Maurice had refused to carry a radio transmitter because that would have been too much civilization.
That's a big mistake.
And they went afloat in a dinghy for 117 days before being picked up by a South Korean fishing boat.
Oh my goodness.
So interestingly, almost nobody, until this book came out, almost nobody in England remembered this story, but it's a national holiday in South Korea. They remember it to this very day as a South Korean triumph of rescue.
Goodness.
And what's also amazing, that couple stayed married.
Oh, wow. All right, Greg, we'll keep it with you. Pull your list out again and give us a very, very quick summary for those who are joining us a bit later. We're kind of drive time here at noon, people in and out of the car.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Give us your four, okay?
My four books are C.M. Cushing's Cooler Than Cool, The Life and Work of Elmore Leonard. The title says it all. Sarah Wynn Williams' Careless People, A Cautionary Tale of Power, Greed, and Lost Idealism, A Takedown of Facebook as an Authoritarian Institution. David Litt, It's Only Drowning, A True Story of Learning to Surf and the Pursuit of Common Ground. Charming, lovely book. Even if you don't like to surf, it's a fun read. Mm-hmm. And finally, Sophie Elmhurst's A Marriage at Sea, The True Story of Love, Obsession, and Shipwreck. And I think of those four, if I had to read only one, it would be that last one, Sophie Elmhurst's.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely check that one out.
Fascinating true adventure story.
Bruce Dingus, sum it up for us.
Ron Chernow, Mark Twain, a great 1,200-page beach read.
1,200? Okay.
A lot of footnotes. Aaron John Curtis, Old School Indian, a debut novel about discovering an Indian heritage, recovering an Indian heritage. Dagoberto Gilb, A Passing West, Essays from the Borderlands, which pretty much says it all. And Brian Burrow, The Gunfighters, How Texas Made the Wild West. Probably the most fun read in here.
All right, Bruce Dingus, Greg McNamee, thank you guys.
Thank you, Bill.
For our summer edition of What Are You Reading These Days with Bruce and Greg, and we'll be back with that particular quarterly summary in segment in the fall. So on behalf of my fine literary critics with me and Tom on the other side of the glass, Bill Buckmaster with the same greeting pretty much every day. Hope everybody stays well. Have a great day.